"There's one thing Howard said." Jack looked uneasily from Danielle to Walt.
"Which was?" Danielle asked.
Jack shook his head. "Nah, I was just crazy talk. I figured Howard didn't know what he was talking about."
"Tell us," Danielle urged.
Jack glanced to Walt, who gave him a nod.
"Go ahead. Tell us what Howard said," Walt urged.
Jack let out a deep sigh and said, "After the boat filled up with water, I came to the realization I was already dead. They started leaving. One by one, they vanished."
"I assume you're talking about the spirits," Danielle asked.
Jack nodded. "Yes. They had stopped screaming at each other. It was so quiet on board, even though I could still see them all, watching each other, no longer saying anything. Silently, one by one, they vanished. The bodies, which had been on the floor, began to bloat and rise to the ceiling. I thought they'd all left. I panicked and ran back into the first cabin I had been in. Howard was still there."
"Howard's spirit?" Danielle asked.
"Yes. Thelma was gone, but Howard was still there. Right before he vanished, he looked at me and said, 'I wonder what Marlowe had to pay to kill us all.'"
14. Adam had just sat down in a seat across from Bill Jones at Pier Cafe when he heard someone shout,
"If it belongs to Boatman, I say she can haul it off."
Adam craned out from the booth to see who was doing all the shouting. The voice was coming from two booths down. He could see the back of one man's head, but the one who was doing all the animated ranting faced Adam. It was Pete Rogers. Settling back in his seat, Adam looked at Bill, who just shook his head and took a sip of his coffee.
"What's Rogers' problem?" Adam asked Bill, just as Carla approached their table with a pot of coffee.
"They've been going at it all morning," Carla explained as she filled Adam's cup.
"Do you know what they're arguing about? I heard them mention Boatman. Are they talking about Danielle?"
"Isn't Frederickport drama normally centered on Boatman?" Bill asked.
Carla leaned down, her nose just inches from Adam. In a loud whisper, she said,
"It's that ghost ship that washed up by Danielle's house."
Carla gave a nod and stood back up straight again. Adam picked up his coffee cup.
"Pete expects Danielle to move it?"
"The Historical Society had an emergency meeting last night," Carla said in an excited whisper. "When the police finish with the boat, they want it turned over to the Historical Society."
Adam frowned. "What for?"
Bill chuckled.
"Those idiots want to make some historical exhibit out of it. But Pete's not thrilled with the idea since it's not that far from his back patio. Can't say I blame him."
"What does that have to do with Danielle?" Adam asked.
"She inherited the Marlowe estate," Carla explained. "According to this morning's paper, that boat belonged to Walt Marlowe."
"Yeah, I know about that." Adam sipped his coffee.
"So the Historical Society wants the boat left there?"
"Have you seen it yet?" Bill asked.
"Yeah, I don't see how it'd do much for local property values. The thing's an eyesore," Adam said.
Carla topped off Bill's cup and set the coffee pot on the table.
"I just know Pete's not happy about it."
She pulled her order pad and pen from her apron's pocket.
"You guys ready to order yet?"
After Carla took their order and left the table, Bill said,
"I sure as hell wouldn't want to be responsible for hauling that monstrosity off. I wonder where it's been."
"It must have been at sea all this time."
Bill grabbed a sugar packet from the end of the table and tore it open. As he dumped it into his cup, he said,
"Can you imagine coming across something like that while out fishing? Have you seen it yet?"
"Yeah, I stopped by this morning. It's all taped off. Can't get close to it. I guess they've had a cop down there 24/7.
Bill picked up a spoon and stirred his coffee. Considering they found human bones on board, I imagine they want to see if there are more.
I don't think that's why they won't let anyone near it. Probably has something to do with what they found yesterday.
What are you talking about?
Bill tossed the spoon aside and picked up his mug.
I guess it hasn't been on the radio yet. I imagine they're keeping tight-lipped about it.
Tight-lipped about what?
The cops found a treasure on board.
Adam perked up.
A treasure? What kind of treasure? A freaking fortune in jewelry. Maybe not worth as much as the missing Thorndyke, but close.
Jewelry?
Vintage stuff, all in pristine condition. They called in a jeweler from Astoria to have a look at it. He was there last night. A freaking fortune.
I'm surprised there wasn't anything in the newspaper about it.
They probably consider this an ongoing investigation. Maybe they don't want the public to know yet. My friend wasn't supposed to say anything, so keep this between us.
Ongoing investigation? What for?
They think it might be stolen, Bill explained.
Stolen? Why would they think that? It probably belonged to some passenger on board the ship when it went down.
Bill shook his head.
Nope. The metal box it was in was fairly new. From Walmart. It still had a price sticker on the bottom. While I said it was vintage jewelry, I also said it was in pristine condition. According to my friend, the jeweler said there was no way it had been on that boat all those years.
Adam considered the scenario a moment and then let out a chuckle.
Can you imagine pulling off some jewel heist and then stashing your loot on an old boat and to have not only the loot disappear, but the entire damn boat?
I suppose this means that boat must have been washed up somewhere all these years. But where?
I have no idea.
Adam sipped his coffee.
And now that it's here, I can't believe anyone would want to keep it.
If I had a house along that stretch of beach, I wouldn't be too thrilled either.
What's the Historical Society thinking? They don't seriously want to take responsibility for that thing. Can you imagine the liability?
Bill shrugged.
I doubt they've gotten that far.
Obviously not.
That reminds me. Is it true about Boatman donating an emerald to the museum?
Didn't you read the article in the newspaper? Adam asked.
Yes, but it didn't make any sense. Something about an emerald from the missing Thorndyke. Why would she take one of the emeralds out of the necklace?
Adam leaned back in his seat.
She's not taking one of the emeralds out of the necklace. That would be crazy, considering what that thing's worth.
Bill frowned, shaking his head.
Then why did they say she was donating an emerald from it?
Don't you ever read?
Obviously, I didn't read about this.
You going to tell me or are you just going to be a jerk? Bill snapped.
The original diamonds and emeralds were stolen from the necklace before it went missing and were replaced with fakes. Eva Thorndyke's parents found out and had the fakes replaced before Walt Marlowe stole it.
Yeah, I remember all that. But what does it have to do with the emerald Boatman's giving to the museum?
You know who Heather Donovan is? Adam asked.
The woman with the mold?
Yeah, she's also the one who inherited Presley House. I guess her great-grandfather, the one who built Presley House, was involved in the original Thorndyke jewel heist. One of the missing emeralds was passed down in her family.
So why does Boatman have it?
Heather returned the emerald to Danielle.
Returned it to Boatman? Why in the hell would she do that?
Adam shrugged.
I guess she figured the emerald belonged to her.
Why? She's not related to Eva Thorndyke. Why would Donovan give Boatman the emerald? Hell, it's not as if she needs the money. Danielle Boatman is loaded, and from what I know about Heather Donovan, she can't afford to be giving away precious gems. If it was me, I wouldn't have given it to Danielle.
Bill laughed.
Then you consider yourself Danielle's friend?
Adam smiled.
True. But as you said, it isn't as if Danielle needs the money. I doubt she cares that much about the emerald. Hell, she's donating it to the museum. I still don't get why Donovan gave it to her.
Because Walt Marlowe inherited the missing Thorndike and Danielle inherited his estate through her aunt. I guess Heather considered Danielle the rightful owner.
Bill silently fidgeted with the handle of his coffee mug as he considered the facts of the missing Thorndike. Finally, he looked up at Adam and said,
"Donovan was a fool. That emerald didn't belong to Marlowe, so there was no reason to give it to Boatman, even if she was the rightful owner of the missing Thorndike." Why do you say that?
Think about it. The Thorndike necklace had three sets of stones, real diamonds and emeralds, fake stones, and a second set of diamonds and emeralds. The first set of real gems was stolen. That's where Donovan's emerald came from. The fakes were removed and given to the jeweler. We know that because Haman had them.
So, the second set of diamonds and emeralds are in the necklace today. The original setting and the second set of precious stones is what Walt Marlowe inherited. The stolen stones, if they belong to anyone else, would belong to the Thorndike family, or their heir. Marlowe just inherited the necklace with the second set of stones. He didn't inherit the first set of stones, the ones that were originally stolen.
Adam stared at Bill a moment, a blank expression on his face. He then started to laugh.
Damn, you're right. I wonder if Heather will ever realize she gave the emerald to the wrong person. Considering how she was bitching about what it was going to cost to get rid of the mold in her house, I have a feeling she's already regretted her generosity.
Bill reached for the pack of cigarettes in his blue work shirt pocket and stood up.
You can't sit for 15 minutes without a smoke.
I'm just having a quick one before Carla brings our breakfast. Stupid smoking laws.
Bill walked outside to have a cigarette, leaving Adam alone. In the adjacent booth, Kurt Jefferson sat alone, quietly finishing his breakfast, while processing the conversation he had just overheard. The urge to hit someone, anyone, was overwhelming. After washing down the last of his bacon and eggs with a now-cold cup of coffee, he shoved his mug and plate aside and stood. Digging one hand into a front pocket of his jeans, he pulled out several bills and angrily tossed them onto the table. 15. Kurt Jefferson hadn't planned to spend his 40th birthday in Frederickport. Last year, his ex-wife had invited him over for a birthday breakfast so he could spend the morning with his son. It was a gracious offer, yet one she hadn't extended for this year. They were no longer on the best of terms, which was partially attributed to the fact that his last two child support payments had been late. He pulled his Jeep up behind the squad car and parked. He sat there a moment, still thinking of what he had overheard at the diner. Pulling his key from the ignition and grabbing his cell phone from the center console, he exited the vehicle. It was breezy out, with temperatures in the mid-50s. He had dressed casually that day, denims, long-sleeved T-shirt, and his windbreaker with the name of his company embossed on the back. Jefferson Diving and Salvage. Stuffing the keys in his front pocket and the phone in his back one, he made his way to the beach. Once he reached the sidewalk, he paused and looked out toward the ocean. There it was, the Eva Aphrodite. He couldn't tell from this angle if it was indeed the same boat, but considering what he had just overheard at the diner, he was fairly certain it was. Stepping onto the sand, he walked toward the boat. It looked larger somehow, perched up on the beach, crowding the area. Space seemed greater on the bottom of the ocean, and the boat smaller. Silently he approached, looking up at the name on the boat's bow.
Eva Aphrodite, the lettering was the same. Yet he couldn't even imagine how the yacht, or what was left of it, got here.
"That's far enough," Kurt heard someone yell out.
Looking to his left, he watched as a police officer walked in his direction.
"I'm just looking," Kurt called back.
The cop pointed down to the portion of yellow tape under Kurt's feet. Looking down, Kurt abruptly stepped back. He hadn't even noticed the tape surrounding the boat, or the fact he was standing on it. On closer inspection, he realized one reason he hadn't noticed. Much of the tape was covered by sand. When the officer reached him, Kurt read his name tag.
"Sorry, Officer Henderson. I didn't even notice the tape."
"No problem." Officer Brian Henderson turned to face the boat.
"It's really something, isn't it?" "Any idea how it got here?" Kurt asked.
Brian shook his head.
"That's the current mystery."
Under his breath, he added,
"One of them." "I'd love to have a closer look. Do you think it would be possible for me to take a look inside?" "Sorry, we can't let anyone on her just yet." "What are the plans for it?"
Brian shrugged.
"I know there are some who'd like her to stay here." "Like the Peter Iredale?" Kurt asked. "Exactly. But I've been hearing from a few of the local property owners. They aren't thrilled with the idea."
Kurt stared up at the wreckage.
"No, I can't imagine they are." "Is this your first time seeing it?" "Yes, I'm from Astoria. I own a diving and salvaging company. Heard about this on the news and was curious to see it in person." "Any chance you've ever seen this before?" Brian asked with a chuckle. "We'd sure like to figure out where she came from." "Sorry, I can't help you there." "Well, go have a look around. Just stay on this side of the tape. I have to go make a call." "Sure, no problem."
Kurt stood silently looking up at the Eva Aphrodite as the officer walked toward the street. After a moment, Kurt began walking the boat's perimeter. He had never seen it from this angle before, looking up at it as opposed to looking down from the upper deck. He studied the wreckage. When he came to its stern and the gaping hole, Kurt froze. There was no mistake. It was the same boat. He could feel his hand tremble as he pulled the cell phone from his back pocket to make the call. After two rings, she answered.
"Hey, what's going on?"
"I'm down here," Kurt told her.
"Down here where?" she asked.
"Standing on the beach, looking up at the Eva Aphrodite. It's the same boat."
"I told you it was."
"This is impossible."
"Anything's possible," she countered.
Holding the cell phone by his ear, Kurt walked slowly around the boat as he talked on the phone.
"I found out something interesting this morning."
"What was that?"
"I know what was in the box."
Silence.
"Why did you do it?" he asked.
"That's really none of your business."
"What do you mean it's none of my business? You do know the cops have it now, don't you?"
"That doesn't surprise me, considering they've been going through the boat since it washed up on shore."
"Is this what you wanted, for them to find it?"
She laughed before saying,
"Don't be ridiculous. How did I know the damn boat was going to find its way back here?"
"You don't sound very upset."
"What am I going to do about it now?"
"You put a fortune in that damn box. How do you plan to get it back?" he asked.
"I don't plan to get it back."
"This is insane."
"What do you expect me to do? March up to the cops and say, 'Excuse me, I left a little something on that boat, and I want to pick it up.'"
He didn't think she sounded upset.
"If you'll remember, I'm the one who put that box on the boat."
"It's not yours," she reminded him. "This is for the best. It's not what I originally planned, but perhaps this is how it's supposed to be.
Listen, maybe you can walk away from a fortune like that, but I can't. I need the money.
We had a deal, Kurt. You were paid well.
Not well enough to walk away from this, he hissed.
There's nothing you can do now.
If you can afford to just walk away from a fortune, then you can afford to pay me more.
Fortune? Who said it was worth a fortune? She asked.
That's what the guy said.
What guy? Where are you getting all this, Kurt?
When I went to breakfast this morning, I heard some guys talking. One of them knew all about the vintage jewelry you stashed in that box. They even had some jeweler from Astoria come check it out.
She laughed. So now you're picking up your intel at the local diner?
Was it wrong?
I can't give you any more money.
She was no longer laughing. Yes, you can, or I go to the police.
We have a contract. You signed a confidentiality agreement. If you tell anyone, I'll sue you.
Jack thought there was something familiar about the man. It wasn't until he said, I'm the one who put that box on the boat, did he know who he was. He was about the right height and size. Of course, the more he thought about it, he wondered why he hadn't figured it out sooner. After all, it had been almost 100 years since he had seen anyone, and everyone he once knew had long since died. In his defense, he had never seen the man's face. Jack had returned to the beach the night before, after meeting with Walt for the second time since his return to Frederickport. The meeting had not ended well. After telling Danielle and Walt what Howard had said before leaving the ship, Walt called him a liar and vanished. Danielle wanted him to stay. She had more questions. Jack had nothing else he wanted to say to Danielle, so he followed Walt's cue and vanished. He didn't go far. Just up the street, back to the Eva Aphrodite. The man he recognized carried a telephone in his hand and continued to talk into it. Jack couldn't understand how the phone worked without a cord. So much had changed in the last 90-plus years. When Danielle had taken him over to Marlowe House the previous day, she had pulled one of those gadgets from her pocket and looked at it. When he had asked her what she was doing, she explained she was reading a text message on her cell phone.
"What's a cell phone?" he had asked.
"It's a telephone, but unlike the phone from your era, it does more and it doesn't need to be plugged in. Lily just sent me a message, and I guess we should stop talking out here. People are starting to watch." Jack had a few questions of his own for Danielle. There was so much about this new world he didn't understand. Yet he was anxious to leave Marlowe House and put some distance between him and Walt. Perhaps if Jack could remember what had happened those many years ago, he would be more willing to stick around and convince his old friend to listen to him. Unfortunately, he couldn't remember, and it was entirely possible Walt was right. Perhaps he had stolen the money. Jack remembered he had moved the money from its hiding place in his room at George's, but it wasn't to take it to Marlowe House. Back then, perhaps he should have talked to Walt, explained what was going on, that he was in trouble, but he had wanted to handle it himself. What he had finally decided to do, Jack couldn't quite wrap his mind around. Those last days were lost in a distant fog. Focusing his attention back on the man talking on the cell phone, Jack moved closer to him. Maybe he couldn't remember what had happened during his final days, but that didn't mean he couldn't try to figure out why this man had left the box on the boat and what it all meant, if it meant anything at all. Kurt stood by the stern of the wreckage and shoved his cell phone into his back pocket. He could see the police officer walking toward the other side of the boat, talking into his cell phone.
Turning from the ship, Kurt walked toward the ocean, stopping just a few feet from where the waves washed up on shore. He looked out, wondering how the Eva Aphrodite managed to get from its former home to this site. None of it made sense. He felt a hand touch his shoulder, startling him. Turning abruptly to face whoever it was, he was surprised to discover he was still alone. The officer remained a good distance from him, still talking on his cell phone. Reaching up and touching his right shoulder, Kurt glanced around quickly.
"I could swear someone just touched me," he muttered.
Shaking it off, he turned back to face the ocean. He felt it again. Yet this time, it felt more like a finger poking his right shoulder.
"What the?"
Kurt said with a shout as he abruptly swung around to face whoever was playing tricks on him. Yet he was still alone. Again, he looked up and down the beach. Still holding his shoulder, he absently massaged it and glanced around nervously. After a few moments, Kurt convinced himself it must have been the wind, or perhaps a seagull dive-bombed him and escaped undetected. No longer rubbing his shoulder, he dropped his hand to his side and was about to leave when something abruptly shoved him in the back. Again, turning and finding nothing, Kurt let out a curse and took off in a run, heading for his jeep. Jack stood on the beach, laughing. "When was the last time I've laughed like this?" Jack asked himself. A broad smile on his face, Jack watched the man run from the beach.
Damn, that was fun.
16. Joanne Johnson, Marlowe House's housekeeper and occasional cook, unpacked the groceries Lily had picked up that morning, putting them away in the refrigerator and pantry. It was mid-morning on Friday. Guests were arriving that afternoon, one couple from Portland and a writer from Washington State. Joanne had already prepared the rooms, putting clean linens on the beds and setting out the towels. The writer from Washington would be staying upstairs in the red room, and a couple from Portland would be staying in the downstairs bedroom, as the husband had a problem navigating the stairs. Danielle was still contemplating renaming the rooms. Initially, she had named the upstairs bedrooms by color, eventually regretting her decision. However, she hadn't yet decided on new names, so for now, rooms on the second floor were by color, while the downstairs bedroom was simply called the downstairs bedroom, and the attic room, a room which had only been used by one guest, was called the attic room. While Joanne organized the kitchen and prepped the food for Saturday's breakfast, Lily was in the side yard instructing the gardener on a few changes they wanted to make in the landscaping. Upstairs, Danielle sat alone in her bedroom, trying to decide if she should sit down with Walt and tell him everything she knew about the Eva Aphrodite. They hadn't yet discussed what Jack had said before Walt's hasty departure, nor the murdered passengers and crew, and Walt knew nothing about the mysterious jewelry found on board. Walt normally came to her room each evening, and the two had discussed the day's events or simply say goodnight. Yet Walt hadn't shown himself last night or this morning. Taking a deep breath, Danielle stood up and decided to talk to him. Just as she stepped out of her bedroom, she heard Sadie racing up the stairs, the nails of the dog's paw scraping against the wood steps as she made her ascent. The sound of the front door slamming shut could be heard, along with Ian's voice calling out an unenthusiastic, "Sadie?" Never really imagining the dog would listen to him. Under most conditions, Sadie was a perfectly behaved, well-trained golden retriever who listened and obeyed her master's commands. At Marlowe House, not so much. Ian had come to accept his dog's peculiar behavior when visiting his neighbor's house. Since Danielle didn't mind Sadie's obsession with Marlowe House's attic, Ian had given up trying to keep Sadie downstairs.
Hey, girl,
Danielle called out to Sadie, who had just reached the second floor landing. Wagging her tail, Sadie briefly turned Danielle's way, let out a short bark, and then continued on, charging up the attic stairs to Walt. Danielle glanced briefly back into her room. Max, who had been sleeping soundly on the end of her bed, had just lifted his head, the dog's noisy arrival disturbing the cat's slumber. Closing his eyes and letting out a lazy yawn, displaying his razor-sharp feline teeth, Max dropped his chin back onto his front paws and went back to sleep. Smiling at Max, Danielle pulled her bedroom door almost shut, leaving it open several inches so that Max could get out later when he finished napping. Danielle found Walt upstairs in the attic, sitting on the sofa bed, while Sadie danced around on his lap, paws disappearing through Walt's thighs, while the dog's tail swished back and forth, unencumbered.
"Sadie, off the sofa," Danielle ordered as she approached them.
"Spoil sport," Walt teased,
while he instructed Sadie to do as Danielle commanded. The dog jumped to the floor and curled up on Walt's feet.
"You've been making yourself scarce," Danielle said as she took a place on the sofa.
"I've been doing a lot of thinking."
He glanced down at Sadie.
"I take it Ian is here?"
"I would have assumed you saw him walk over."
Walt shrugged.
"I've been sitting here. I haven't been looking out the window."
"I heard him come in downstairs a minute ago, and Sadie is here. So, yeah, I guess he is."
"Where's Jack?" Walt asked.
"Unless he's moved on, I assume down with the Eva Aphrodite. He took off right after you disappeared last night."
"I had nothing more to say to him, especially after all that nonsense he spouted about Howard. Does he really expect me to believe Howard blamed me for the storm? Exactly how does one pay to rustle up a storm?"
Danielle turned on the sofa to face Walt, resting her left elbow on the back cushion.
"I don't think Howard was talking about a storm."
"I doubt Howard said anything. Jack is just trying to deflect. He took that money. He betrayed me and the powers that be sent him to the Eva Aphrodite to serve out his penance."
"Actually, Walt, there's a few things I haven't told you."
Walt studied Danielle.
"What few things?"
"Maybe a storm took your yacht down, but it didn't kill the passengers and crew. They were already dead."
"Don't be absurd. What do you mean, already dead?"
"The chief and his men have been going through the boat. They found human remains. Well, not a lot, actually. Being under the ocean for that long has a way of making all signs of life, or death, disappear. But they did find skulls."
Walt cringed.
"I would prefer not to think of my old friends in that way."
He stood up. "But we have to talk about it." Walt walked to the window and looked outside.
"What's the point? They've been dead for almost 100 years.
"They were murdered, Walt. Each skull came with its own bullet."
Walt turned from the window and stared at Danielle. "Are you telling me they were shot?"
"According to the chief, each skull they found had a bullet lodged in it. Those people were executed. Someone murdered them. Their deaths had nothing to do with a storm." His expression unreadable, Walt made his way back to the sofa and sat down. Staring ahead blankly, he shook his head.
"I don't believe this."
"It's true. Man, I'll be honest with you. The chief believes you might have been involved."
With a quick jerk of his head, Walt faced Danielle. Narrowing his eyes, he said,
"He believes I killed those people?"
"Or paid to have someone do it, which apparently is something Howard wondered before his spirit decided to move on."
You certainly don't believe that, do you?
Danielle smiled at Walt. If I did, I wouldn't be telling you this. The chief wanted me and Lily to move out of Marlowe House while he investigates the murders.
Investigates the murders? From over 90 years ago? I imagine the responsible party has long been dead.
Danielle shrugged. True, but the chief knows your spirit is here, that you're capable of harnessing energy, and if you had those people killed, he's afraid of what you might be capable of doing if provoked.
Walt stood angrily and shouted, I'll show him exactly what I'm capable of doing.
Danielle chuckled. Seriously, Walt, you're angry at the chief for worrying about Lily and me? Remember how you felt about Harvey?
Well, that was different. I had good reason to be worried. Harvey could have gotten you killed.
The chief doesn't know you. He's never met you. Put yourself in his shoes. He knows you're confined to Marlowe House, that your powers don't extend beyond these walls. So naturally, he would feel more comfortable having us somewhere where you can't reach us. After all, it's not like he can come in and arrest you. Letting out a sigh, Walt plopped back down on the sofa. Sadie looked up at him and let out a short bark.
Fine, Sadie, you don't need to nag, Walt grumbled.
Danielle glanced down at the dog.
What did she say?
It doesn't matter, just that she agrees with you.
Reaching down, Danielle ruffled Sadie's fur.
Good girl, smart dog.
Walt leaned back and closed his eyes.
Does Lily know about any of this?
Yes. She knows the chief wanted us to stay somewhere else until he could learn more. Walt opened his eyes and looked at Danielle.
Is Lily afraid to stay here?
Obviously not. She's still here. I don't believe you had anything to do with those people's deaths.
I didn't. But what I don't understand, why in the world would the chief imagine for a moment I did? I know we've never actually met, but what motive would I have to murder my crew and customers, many who were personal friends, aboard my yacht?
Well, I think it had something to do with what Ben told him.
Ben?
Ben Smith, from the museum.
What could he have possibly said? Walt asked.
Well, I haven't actually talked to Ben yet. Danielle stood up. But apparently there's an old rumor about you and one of the passengers. A married woman. Something about an affair between you two.
Walt stared at Danielle.
Waving a hand, he summoned a lit cigar and took a puff. Leaning back in the sofa, one leg propped over the opposing knee, Walt studied Danielle.
If I was having an affair with a married woman, and for whatever reason found it inconvenient and wanted to get rid of her, don't you think it would be a bit overkill, literally, to massacre everyone on board?
Still standing, Danielle faced Walt. I didn't say you did it, but you asked why the chief suspected you had something to do with it.
Then you can ask the chief the same question I just asked you.
I think there was more to it than you being intimately involved with one of the passengers.
More? How?
Danielle shrugged.
I don't know.
Like I said, I haven't been able to see Ben yet to find out all that he told the chief. And the chief seems reluctant to tell me everything Ben said.
I thought you and the chief were good friends, that you shared this kind of information with each other.
He doesn't tell me everything, and you know, I don't tell him everything.
True.
Walt took another puff off his cigar. There's something else. Not sure what it has to do with the murders, but it's bizarre.
Danielle pulled her iPhone out of her back pocket. Bizarre? How?
Joe found a box on board the Eva Aphrodite. It was filled with old jewelry. Danielle looked at her phone and opened her photo app, locating the picture she had taken.
Old jewelry?
Yes. I took these pictures at the chief's office. Danielle showed Walt the photographs on the iPhone, scrolling through each one. Walt leaned close to the phone, studying the images.
I recognize those pieces.
You should. Danielle opened the photograph of the three women and showed it to Walt. He studied it for a moment, let out a sigh, and then leaned back in the sofa.
Nothing remarkable about that. They were all on the Eva Aphrodite when it went missing. Maybe the boat was boarded by pirates and they removed their jewelry and hid it in a cabin, thinking it would keep them safe.
The problem with that scenario is the items were found in a box. A box that wasn't that old. A box from Walmart.
Walmart?
It's a store that wasn't around when you were alive. The box still had a price tag from Walmart on it. Plus, the condition of the jewelry was not what one would expect it might be, left all those years in damp salt air. Not to mention, Jack confirmed to me a diver placed the box on the Eva Aphrodite just a day before he brought the boat here. Walt said nothing for a few moments, considering all that Danielle had told him. Finally, he looked at her and said,
"We have to find out what happened on that boat. I need to know. Was Jack involved?"
17. Floor-to-ceiling bookshelves lined two of the four walls in the darkly paneled room. The impressive collection of leather-bound books captured Roland Sterling's full attention, much to his wife's annoyance.
"You can look at the books later," Stella told Roland. "I want to see the sunken ship."
Danielle wondered if portly Roland, who was a good head shorter than his wife, had once been the taller spouse. Considering how the woman had been harping at her poor husband since their arrival, Danielle thought it was entirely possible she might have beaten him down over the years. To Danielle's surprise, he ignored his wife's newest demand and asked,
"Did they all belong to Walt Marlowe?"
By the way his gaze lingered over the collection, Danielle guessed Mr. Sterling was a lover of books. After checking them into their room downstairs, Danielle had begun to give the older couple a quick tour of the house when the library had stopped Mr. Sterling in his tracks. "Pretty much," Danielle replied. "I added a few, but most of my books, the ones I brought with me from California, I keep in my room or in the parlor. From what I understand, Walt Marlowe was a voracious reader."
"Roland," Stella said impatiently as she tugged on the sleeve of his sweater. "I want to go see it before it gets dark."
Roland let out a weary sigh, and instead of reminding his wife there was plenty of daylight left, as it was barely 2 p.m., he reluctantly acquiesced to her demand. Turning to Danielle, he asked,
"Where did you say we can see this boat?"
"It's just up the street. It's a short walk. You'll see the police car parked along the side of the road. You can enter the beach there."
"And you say Walt Marlowe owned it?" Stella asked Danielle as they walked toward the door leading to the front hallway.
"Yes, it was his yacht."
"Yacht?
My, he must have been rich," Stella said.
"But you can't really tell by this house."
"Stella," Roland scolded under his breath.
Danielle glanced at Roland and smiled, noting the red blush coloring his pale complexion.
"I'm just saying this is a rather ordinary house for someone who owned a yacht."
"Did he own other homes?" Stella asked.
No, just this one.
This house was built by his grandfather, Frederick Marlowe, who founded the town." Danielle walked the couple to the front door.
"I think it's a beautiful house," Roland said, flashing Danielle an apologetic smile.
A few minutes later, Danielle chuckled to herself as she closed the front door after Roland and Stella Sterling went off to see the Eva Aphrodite. Mrs. Sterling had heard about the wreckage on the radio during their drive to Frederickport. She was thrilled to discover it had washed up on a beach not far from the bed and breakfast. Danielle was just heading to the kitchen to talk to Joanne when her cell phone rang. Pulling it from her back pocket, she saw the caller was Chris. Stepping into the parlor, she answered the phone.
"Hi there, how's it going?" she asked.
"Everything's going along as planned," Chris told her.
"How's it going there? Any new developments?"
Danielle took a seat on the sofa and spent the next 10 minutes filling Chris in on what had been going on regarding the Eva Aphrodite since their last phone call.
"Never a dull moment in Frederickport. Have your weekend guests arrived?"
"Yes, the couple from Portland, the one staying in your room."
"My room?"
Chris sounded amused.
"You better not let Walt hear you say that. Where is he, by the way?"
Danielle glanced up to the ceiling. "In the attic. Or at least he was, the last time I checked."
"So what were you saying about the couple from Portland?"
"I put them in the downstairs bedroom because of the stairs. Retired couple. When they made the reservation, they mentioned something about his artificial knee and wanted to know if I had a room on the ground floor. I think I told you about the other guest. She's a writer.
A mystery writer.
Seems very nice and interesting. She's upstairs right now getting settled in her room. The Portland couple just took off to see the Eva Aphrodite."
"The writer? Is that the one who's staying a month?"
"Yes. From what I understand, this is a working vacation. She'll be writing a new book here. Wants to do it someplace where she'll be inspired."
Chris laughed. "A haunted house would be the perfect place."
"In all fairness," Danielle chuckled, "she doesn't know it's haunted."
"Any chance you might be able to get away for about an hour or so this afternoon?"
"I suppose. Joanne is here. What do you need?"
"Adam called me. Escrow is scheduled to close on the Gusarov place this afternoon, and since I'm not there to do a final walkthrough with him, I was wondering if you might go over there and do it for me."
"Sure. But isn't it just a technicality?"
"Well, you never know. Maybe some kids got in there within the last couple weeks and vandalized the place. Or the light fixtures decided to fall from the ceilings. And while I basically trust Adam..."
"He is still Adam," Danielle finished for him. She could hear Chris chuckle.
"I'd just feel better if you did it with him."
"No problem. But what if I find a, a ghost in residence?"
"You told me Stoddard and Darlene aren't haunting that place."
"Well, I don't think they are, and neither of us noticed anything when Adam took us over there a couple weeks ago. But still, it's always possible."
"I don't want a haunted house."
"Does this mean if I come across a ghost during the walkthrough, you want to cancel the deal?" Chris didn't answer immediately. Finally, he said,
"No, I hate seeing a grown man cry. I'm pretty certain if I canceled now, Adam would start sobbing."
"Considering you're in Chicago and I'm the one in Frederickport, it would be a dirty trick to leave me with a blubbering Adam to soothe.
Not to mention, the last time I looked, canceling a real estate deal because of ghosts isn't a valid reason."
"I'll go over there. Do I need to call Adam, or is he going to call me?"
"I told him you'd call him if you can go. Thanks, Danielle. I appreciate it."
Friday's late afternoon breeze sent the front shrubbery at the Gusarov estate leaning north, while tree branches brushed repeatedly against the front windows. The landscaping had been severely neglected since Darlene Gusarov's death. Upstairs, all the blinds remained closed, as did all the window coverings on the lower floor, except for the large picture window in the living room. Danielle sat in her car parked in front of the property, waiting for Adam's arrival. She remembered the first time she had seen the estate, after she had first arrived in Frederickport during the past summer.
Back then, she had assumed it was an industrial building, considering its massive size and utilitarian feel. The wrought iron fence surrounding the property was its only feature that hinted at residence instead of business. The sound of a horn honking interrupted Danielle's mental wandering. Glancing up in her rearview mirror, she saw Adam parking his car behind her. Pulling her key from the ignition, she grabbed her purse off the passenger seat and exited the flex. 30 minutes later, Adam and Danielle finished the walkthrough. She hadn't noticed a single lingering spirit. The rooms were all empty, devoid of both spirits and furniture. Danielle assumed all the furnishings and personal belongings of the Gusarovs had been sold. It reminded her of a blank slate, ready for Chris to transform. It wouldn't be his home, but the new headquarters for his non-profit organization. Danielle stood on the front porch, watching Adam lock up the house.
"Are you still donating that emerald to the museum?" Adam asked, as he turned from the front door and slipped the keys into his front pocket.
"Yeah. In fact, I'm supposed to meet with some of the Historical Society's board members in the morning to discuss it." Danielle and Adam made their way down the front walk toward the street.
"I still find it odd Heather gave it to you. If you think about it, Walt Marlowe didn't actually inherit the original gemstones from the necklace, just the second set."
"I've pointed that out to Heather on numerous occasions. I even offered to give it back to her after she had to move out of her house because of the mold. I know the repairs cost her a fortune, and considering she just lost the Presley property, she needed the money."
"From what I hear, nothing ever came of that," he said when they reached the sidewalk.
"You mean, did Morris illegally get a hold of the property?" Danielle asked.
"I know she originally thought that."
"From what I understand, it turned out Morris got a hold of it legally. Not much she can do about it now. The last time I discussed it with her sounded like she'd come to the conclusion it was for the best. Heather is big on karma."
"You mean the sins of the father? Or, in this case, the sins of the great-grandfather?"
Adam walked Danielle to her car.
"Pretty much." "Then I suppose it's a good thing I don't have any kids," Adam said as he opened her car door for her.
Danielle flashed him a bemused smile as she got into the vehicle.
"Why do you say that?"
"Think about it. Would be rather unfair to saddle my kids, or theirs, with karma I generated."
"Ah, because you're such a bad guy?" Danielle asked with a chuckle as she pulled her car door shut and looked up at Adam through the open window.
"I try," he said with a laugh.
Adam's question about Heather and the emerald prompted Danielle to stop by Heather's before returning to Marlowe House. Less than 15 minutes after leaving Adam, she sat in Heather's kitchen, watching her neighbor prepare them each a cup of green tea. Taking a deep breath, Danielle inhaled a hint of peppermint. She spied a diffuser sitting on the counter in the corner of the kitchen, a stream of steam swirling upward from its lid. Danielle was fairly certain that was the source of the peppermint.
"So, what about the emerald?" Heather asked, as she handed Danielle a cup of tea and joined her at the table.
"Tomorrow I finalize the plans with the museum, and I just wanted to check with you first. Like I said before, I really don't believe I'm the emerald's rightful owner." Heather shrugged and took a sip of tea before responding.
"Neither am I. You're the closest thing, in my opinion. Plus, I rather like the idea of donating it to the museum. I think you made a good call there."
"Maybe it should be you who donates the emerald, not me." Heather shook her head.
"No, absolutely not. I don't want anything to do with all that. I'm glad you're donating it, but I don't want to be involved. I did what I needed to do. I returned the emerald and sent it on its rightful course."
"An emerald has a destiny?" Danielle asked herself, resisting the urge to giggle. Heather looked up from her tea, looking Danielle in the eyes,
her expression serious. But now that we're discussing this, there is something I've wanted to talk to you about, without Lily around.
Danielle took a sip of tea and then set the cup back on its saucer. She studied Heather's almost pleading expression.
What's that?
Back on Halloween, after we got out of Presley House, we talked about Harvey. You admitted seeing him, and yet since that time, it's like none of it ever happened. It's like, well, sometimes I wonder, am I crazy?
With a deep sigh, Danielle glanced down to her tea and then looked back up.
Heather, who Danielle often saw as not just quirky, but opinionated and overconfident, now reminded her of an uncertain little girl, a look reinforced by her childish black pigtails.
No, you aren't crazy. Danielle's voice was almost a whisper.
So you did see him. I didn't imagine it all.
I know you plan to write a book about what happened, but I'll be honest, I don't feel comfortable being included in your book. I don't want to go public with what I personally experienced.
Why, Danielle? If you aren't willing to verify it happened, no one will believe me.
Because I know what it feels like when people start looking at you like you're crazy. I remember how it felt when my parents sent me to a psychologist because they couldn't believe I was really seeing ghosts. I've learned, Heather, some gifts are best kept to yourself or shared with a select group of people.
So Harvey wasn't really your first ghost?
Danielle shook her head.
No, Heather, he wasn't.
18. Roland and Stella stood behind the yellow tape and watched the police officers haul equipment from the police van parked on the side of the street to the wreckage. Stella had been shooting questions at the officers, but so far, the only response she had received was a request to stand back from the yellow tape.
They're busy, Stella. Stop bothering them, Roland reprimanded her in a hushed voice.
I want to know what they're doing. Why are they putting all that equipment in the boat?
She craned her neck out in hopes of getting a better look.
Roland pointed toward the wreckage.
See over there? That's a generator.
What do they need a generator for? Are they going to start the boat?
Roland laughed.
Hardly.
Don't laugh at me, Stella snapped, flashing her husband an ugly look.
Roland's smile quickly faded.
I'm just saying they're probably using the generator to run those lights they just took onto the ship.
What do they need lights for?
I imagine it's dark inside. Who's the couple gawking and asking questions?
Brian asked when he joined Joe in a cabin on the lower deck.
Other members of their team were busy setting up lights to help them do a more thorough, final inspection of the ship's interior.
From what I gather, they're staying at Marlowe House. Tourists? Brian let out a grunt. I'll just be glad when we're done with this one. We should have brought the generator and lights down yesterday. It's creepy in here.
The ship's interior looked less haunting, fully illuminated. Instead of flashlight beams exposing isolated sections of corroded walls and furnishings, the interior's ambience seemed more exposed and abandoned under the floodlight's harsh glare. After re-exploring the cabin where they had discovered a box of jewelry, Brian and Joe waited for the floodlights to be set up in the adjacent cabin. When they were ready, Brian walked inside and stood by what appeared to be a trunk, shoved and forgotten in the corner, covered with barnacles. Reaching out, he lightly touched the trunk's exterior and said,
"The ship had to have been underwater at one time, and judging by how these feel, it wasn't that long ago. When I came in here the last time, I thought that was part of the wall."
Joe stood next to Brian.
Everything looks different under the floodlights.
Brian reached down and attempted to open the trunk,
but it appeared to be rusted shut. I really don't want to have to drag this thing out of here. Just a second, Joe said.
He left the cabin for a minute and returned with a crowbar. Brian stood by and watched as Joe pried open the trunk's lid. Once loose, Brian and Joe lifted it up,